We are in Matthew chapter 26. We're also in Mark 14. And then we're in Luke chapter 22. We are still going through the life of Christ and trying to tie together the events towards the end now of Jesus' life, just shortly before he went to the cross. Matthew 26 is going to be the primary place that we draw from, but we are going to be, as necessary, skipping around a little bit to try to bring everything into focus. We'll start with Matthew chapter 26, looking at verses 1 through 2, and then as we need some helpers, let's maybe get some people lined up for the other two passages. Who'd like to pull from Mark 14 from time to time? Maybe, okay, if you just maybe put a sheet of paper there, Jeff, and we'll use that occasionally. And then the other parallel that we'll be sometimes using is Luke 22. Who'd like to be on standby for that as we may need it? Luke chapter 22. Somebody want to? Okay, Steve. Again, if you just put a piece of paper there, we'll engage you as necessary. Matthew 26, the first two verses. And it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these words, he said to his disciples, "Ye know that after 2 days the Passover cometh, and the Son of Man is delivered up to be crucified." When you see all these words, or King James translation, all these things, that refers back to something. Now, several weeks ago, we were in Matthew chapter 24. We talked about from Matthew 24, the destruction of Jerusalem, first part of the chapter. In the second part of the chapter, in Matthew 24, we talked about the end of the world. So Jesus went through all that information. Then we have in Matthew 25 some information. You have the wise and you have the foolish virgins. You have the information about the end of time, the sheep and the goats and so forth, "Come, ye blessed of my Father," all that stuff. Now Matthew is saying, after all of this information has been delivered, Jesus, he's taught to the people really all the things that he's wanted to communicate. So the Bible says he's finished all these things. Thus, as we look at Matthew 26, 1 and 2, we have here a major transition. Jesus has essentially concluded his public teaching. He's no longer going to go out and teach the multitudes, because his death is close at hand, and now it's time for him to go ahead and spend some time with his disciples and then go to the cross. Over the years, you've probably read a lot from John 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. But if you've never connected it to the way it should be connected in the life of Christ, let me do that right now for you. Remember in John 13, we have the washing of the feet. John 14 is that place where we have things like, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I am the way, the truth, and the life. In my Father's house are many mansions." John chapter 15 is where we have Jesus saying, "I'm the vine, you're the branches." John 16 is where we have the Lord making various promises about the Holy Spirit. "I need to go away, the Spirit's going to come. He's going to guide you into all the truth." Then in John 17 we have Jesus' great prayer. He talks about unity. That stuff is positioned in a very special spot. Jesus has finished teaching the multitudes. Matthew 26, 1 and 2. Now he's got just a little time left, and what's he going to do? He's going to sit down with those apostles and talk about John 13, John 14, John 15, John 16, John 17, and then it's basically off to the cross. So we will hit in a couple of weeks, three at the most, that information in John 13, but realize from the outset kind of what we're dealing with. All right, the Lord's death was just, as I said, a few days away. It seems this was Wednesday. Jesus was going to be put to death on Friday. So now, about 48 hours from that time, he spent some time with the apostles, and he reminds them in verse 2 about what's about to happen. The Passover is upon them, time for his death. It's interesting when he says, "Ye know," talking to disciples, he uses the perfect tense. What do we remember about the perfect tense? Perfect tense means something was true in the past, and it continues to be true. Thus, the Lord said to his special friends, "You've been aware of this for a long, long time." And as you look at Jesus describing what's going to happen to him, people today, as they describe something that's going to happen to them or might happen to them, what might their demeanor be if it's not too pleasant?
Fearful.
All right, that's going to be, I think, the best word to sum it up. They're scared. There's a great state of anxiety. Do you get the impression in Matthew 26 that Jesus is fearful, or is he calm?
He'd accepted his fate.
All right, he's comfortable in the skin, if you will. You don't have any sense that he's fearful, that he's quaking, shaking, but it is a very reasoned, it's a very well-presented, a very matter-of-fact thing. All right, Jesus says it's about time for the Passover to begin, and this, again, is something that's really, really important. What happened during Passover time? Or, well, let's back up a little bit and rephrase the question. What was the Passover? It was a Jewish... All right, Exodus 11, Exodus chapter 12. And God had this annual feast called the Passover. And if you were a Jew, when it was Passover time, what were you supposed to do? You go back to Jerusalem, and you have there the Passover. You've got the lamb with all the other trimmings. Well, what do you think that did to the population of Jerusalem? It increased it greatly. Some have estimated that there were between 20 and 50,000 people during normal times in Jerusalem, but Josephus, and I think he probably exaggerated and exaggerated a lot, he suggested that during the time of Jesus, the city of Jerusalem had between 2 and 3 million people show up. Well, that's probably far beyond what it was, but there were a huge number of people coming at this particular time. And as Betty mentioned, the Egyptians, they lost the firstborn in Pharaoh's household. Pharaoh would not let the people go. Exodus 12, verse 29, even the firstborn in the dungeon, God didn't overlook them. They also lost their lives. The plague, of course, was stayed. It did not affect the Hebrews if they had the blood on the outside of their houses. Exodus 12, verse 23, and God said at the end of Exodus 12, verses 26 and 27, when people ask, when your children ask in subsequent years, what's the purpose? Why are we having this feast? God said, you tell them about what happened in Egypt. This was the 10th plague, and God's people were allowed to leave after the Passover. Last week, if you were here, we had a handout, and I'm not going to go through that again. If you didn't get a copy of it, we can make that available, but how the Passover pointed forward to Jesus in about 30 or maybe more than 30 different ways. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with verses 3 through 5, Matthew 26? Okay, starting with that third verse. Then were gathered together the chief priests and the elders of the people under the court of the high priest, who was Caiaphas. And they took counsel together that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest a tumult rise among the people. Jesus made that bold prediction about his death, Matthew 26, verse 2. And now we see in these verses that he knew that there were some evil people considering, plotting, if you will, his death. Steve, we've got you on deck for Luke 22, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, if we go to the first part of Luke 22, we'll have kind of a follow-up passage, an additional point in Luke 22, verse 2.
Now the feast of the unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover. And the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people.
Okay. Go ahead. Did I cut you off too soon? Okay, yeah, that's it. Okay. All right, so both Matthew and Luke make it very clear that officials had come together. Matthew tells us that they were in the court of the high priest. The King James translation, I believe, is going to use the word palace, but they were there in the official's residence in his area. Caiaphas, of course, was the high priest, and they wanted to come up with some plan to take the Lord's life. And then it's not going to be too much later. We should get to this tonight, that Judas goes to see some of these fellas and makes a deal. And makes an offer, makes an arrangement, and that gets worked out. All right, why didn't these fellows want to, and we heard this from Steve's reading, why didn't these fellows want to take Jesus during this time?
Fear.
All right, there was fear. Fear of the people. Well, under any circumstances, if you've got 50,000 people in town, that's enough to, you know, stir up quite a big issue, even if you just get a few hundred. But if you've got, with this feast, a lot of people coming in from out of town, maybe some of these people had heard Jesus' teachings. Maybe some of them had been healed. And it's one thing to deal with the local folks, but when you've got some outer towners coming in, good time to do something like this? No, really bad idea. So they did recognize that they were concerned about the people. The word that's translated subtlety, Matthew 26, 4, it's also used in Mark 14, verse 1, describe extreme wickedness. So this is how the Bible pictures the plans to kill Jesus. It was an evil, it was a very, very bad thing. Now, if you have the King James translation, you may have wondered why I didn't read the word scribe in Matthew 26, verse 3. There is a manuscript variation here. Some manuscripts have it, some don't. But the scribes, we would accept, were involved because they are specifically mentioned in Mark 14, verse 1, and there is no question about that passage. Caiaphas, he was the high priest. Annas, we also read about him being the high priest. They were kind of joint for a while. Annas was also the son-in-law of Caiaphas. Matthew only talks about this fella twice. There is the reference here in the first part of the chapter. And then as you move down a little bit, in verses 57 through 66, you find another reference to him. And when it was time for Jesus to have the mock trial before the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas was the one who basically oversaw that. So he was a very important man. He was the fellow who probably had the most power as far as human authority in the land of Israel, and he was not hesitant to use it against the Lord. As you look at these fellows, they're plotting. They may have thought that they were so clever, but ultimately, who was the one that was in charge? Whose will was being done? All right. Remember over in the book of Acts, Peter, on the day of Pentecost, in Acts 2, verse 23, partway through a sermon, he says he was delivered up by the, you remember those words? What kind of counsel? By the determinate counsel and the foreknowledge of God. That's kind of interesting when you think about men today. Folks come along and we've got our plans and we've got our ideas and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. What does God say? You may want to rethink that, because your plans, your thoughts, that may not be the plan that I have, and that may not be my thought. Did people have, prior to this time, any desire? Were they plotting in any way or any sense to do away with Jesus? Do we read about that prior to this time? Yes. Very early in the Lord's life, you have him there, the synagogue in the area of Nazareth. Nazareth, they wanted to go ahead and toss him off the hill, and he got away from them. Whether that was miraculous or not, we don't know, but he was successful on that occasion. We think back to John 11, after he killed Lazarus, they were really upset with him. They wanted to kill him. Back in Matthew 21, verse 46. So there were multiple times where these fellows had wanted to destroy the Lord. But when it comes to something that is part of God's plan, what's true with the timing? God says it's going to be in my time. And you may have some other ideas, but just be prepared to lose, because you are not going to succeed. One source said this from an older commentator, and I liked it. I jotted it down. He said, well-directed public opinion is one of God's most powerful one of God's most powerful instruments for controlling tyrants and oppressors and keeping the world in order. Now think about that. Public opinion is one of God's providential tools for working in the world. Well, that works, doesn't it? A lot of times, the tide of public opinion. You know, people don't like this particular person on the radio, or they don't like something else, so what happens? Petition goes out, call, email, send a letter, and the tide of public opinion doesn't always sway, but sometimes does sway. And governments sometimes have been swayed, or at least some individual decisions have been swayed, simply because so many people said, this is wrong, this is right, and you better get behind this and do it. Anything that you want to add or ask so far from Matthew 26? Okay. Now, I know things may look like we're switching them around a little bit, but to keep them in order, we already talked about the ointment that you have beginning down there with about verse 6. Jesus was in Bethany. This seems to have happened a few days earlier. We've already talked about it. So I want to move down a few verses, starting with verse 14 and reading down through verse 16. Same chapter, Matthew 26. Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot, went into the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me? And I will deliver him unto you. And they weighed unto him 30 pieces of silver. And from that time, he, that would be Judas, sought opportunity to deliver him unto them. Now, when Matthew comes along and says, one of the 12, does that kind of clue you into something? One of the kids, Dad says. What's that tell you? All right, that's a good answer, but I want to make it even a little more basic than that. When somebody says, one of the kids, isn't that a kind of a way of a warning? Well, it could be, but when somebody talks in that kind of way, one of the kids, it warns you that something is going on. There's something that is worthy of attention, and that seems to be what Matthew's trying to say here. One of the 12, it tells us that something is important, something essential is about ready to be introduced, and then Matthew doesn't take long before he launches into describing what that is. He says there's Judas Iscariot. And who did he go see? He went to see the chief priests. And who else did he go see? Isn't there somebody else mentioned? That's apparently in another account. We've got the captains there. I think that's in Luke 22, verse 4, Steve.
So he way and conferred with the chief priests and captains, how he might betray him to them.
Okay, thank you. That's a tough question to answer if the answer is not in the text. All right. He goes to see the chief priests, and who are these captains? What were they captain of? Well, you've only got a couple of choices, right? They were...
Army?
Hmm? Well, you're close. We've only got two choices when we look at the first century world. You were either a Jew or you were a Gentile. All right. So if we're dealing with a captain, someone who's in the military, you either would have been a Gentile captain, which probably wouldn't fit in too well here, or you would have been a Jewish captain. Why would the Jews have had some captains? Kind of like the White House today. They've got their own staff. They've got their own security. What would the Jews have needed that for in the first century? The temple. They had their guards. So you have these officials mentioned as well by Luke. And as Judas goes to see these officials, he says, "What are you willing to give me to deliver Judas?" Now, we're not told all that Judas said to these fellows, but one of the things that kind of interests me, let's go back there and look at Matthew 26, 1 and 2 again. "And it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these things, he told the disciples, 'You know that after 2 days the Passover comes, and what's going to happen to me, the Son of Man? I'm going to and I'm going to die.'" Wouldn't it have been interesting if Judas had gone to these officials and said, "Jesus is talking about death. This guy that you want to get rid of, death is on his mind. He's talked about being dead in 48 hours. You think they might have perked up? I suspect that that might have been very, very interesting news for them. All right, various suggestions have been put forward about Judas's motivation. Maybe the most common one, and I think there's some merit to this, but we can't be sure. But one of the more frequent suggestions is that he was someone who was greedy. Covetousness was something that caused him to deliver up the Lord. If that's true, that's kind of interesting, because greed was one of the things that Jesus taught about, wasn't it? Jesus at times said, a man's life doesn't consist of what he possesses. You know, life is not about covetousness. Judas surely heard at least some of those teachings. But as we look at Judas, there are some things that stand out about this man. Let's pick up a couple of these. Our Mark, that's you, right, Jeff?
Yep.
Our Mark reader, Jeff is going to pick up Mark 14, verse 11. And then we're going to take that passage and compare it to Matthew 26, verse 15.
"And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him."
Okay, now this almost sounds like a TV show. Judas goes to the fellas and says, "All right, what are you going to give me?" And what do? They make a suggestion. And the text says they promised him. Well, if you think about some of the things that Hollywood has produced, when somebody, a bad guy, says, "I promise to give you X number of dollars," the other bad guy might say what? "I don't want a promise. What do I want? I want the cold hard cash." Well, compare that promise with what we find now in Matthew 26, verse 15. "And said, 'What are you willing to give me that I will deliver him unto you?' And then the latter part of 15 says what? And they
paid him 30 pieces of silver."
Wow, isn't that interesting? When you begin to put these two things together, it seems that Judas wasn't willing, even though these people were religious officials, it seems that he was not willing to just accept their word. If I'm going to do this, give me my money now. And then I will go ahead and make good on my deal, but I'm not going to be satisfied with simply a promise. These fellas, according to Matthew, they weighed out the money. He got the 30 pieces of silver. And it seems that they allowed him to take this with them. We don't know the exact amount of 30 pieces of silver. Various estimates have been given. It's been compared to shekels and some other money. Some people think that the 30 pieces of silver would be the Jewish shekel. My best guess on this, and it is a guess, is that it's equivalent to about 4 months' work. 120 days of pay, so 4 months' work, 120 days. Now, that's not a lot of money. I mean, it's not like it's, you know, a day's pay. But still, at the same time, for all that Judas had seen, for all that Jesus had showed him, you still kind of have to look at that and think, well, that really doesn't seem to be a great deal of money. Had a reference here that I wanted to go back. Exodus, I think it's 21:32. Let's head somebody back there. We'll ask you to read that in just a couple of minutes. Exodus 31, verse 32. Somebody want to be on deck for that in a little bit? All right, Betty, thank you. All right, as she's turning back there, let me make a couple other points. It seems like Judas, he's now willing to sell his soul. It looks like he makes this deal on Tuesday. And then by Thursday, within 48 hours, he's been thinking about it for a little while, trying to come up with a good way to do it. And, you know, he's fulfilled this by about a time frame of 48 hours or so. As you look at Matthew 26, verse 16, we also read that verse. Exodus 21, 32. I'll double check that, but that's what sticks in my head. Yeah, 21, 32. As you look at verse 16 from Matthew 26, it says, "And from that time he sought opportunity." Well, if you had to make a good guess about that verb tense, what would you think? He sought opportunity. Sounds like that's what kind of action?
Ongoing
action. So here Judas, as we said, it seems like he's got his money. He's now honest, if you will, in the sense that he's going to fulfill that deal. And mentally, he's thinking about, he's processing different ways to try to come up with an opportunity to betray the Lord. And that word that's translated opportunity in verse 16 is also significant. One source said it seems to convey a particular time of some importance. Well, that's certainly true. A moment that alone is suitable for a specific action. And that's right. We say sometimes today, I'm looking for the right moment. I'm looking for the right opportunity to do this or to say this to someone. It's got to be the perfect time. This is how Judas is pictured as far as his betraying Jesus. Now, going back to the 30 pieces of silver for just a second, there are some people who have looked at this and thought, well, that really isn't a lot of money, especially when you go back and you see what we find in Exodus 21, the 32nd verse. Betty?
If the ox shall push your manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned.
Okay. Ox gored a man, in this case a servant, how much was to be paid? Which is the same that we find when it comes to Judas's betrayal. So that does not seem to be a great deal of money. And there may be a couple of things that we can associate with that. First of all, if a person today does a fee, you know, somebody comes over to the house and changes a light bulb for you, and they say, I want you to pay me for that. Well, you know, what are you going to pay? $1,000? Well, probably not. You know, maybe $5, a couple bucks. Because, you know, people who are trying to do what's right, they will look at the work. And they will try to associate that with the price, which seems appropriate. So if Judas only asked for 30 pieces of silver, what might possibly that indicate about his attitude concerning the betrayal? How much work do you think he may have been thinking, I've got to put into this?
Not very much.
And maybe because he knew Jesus' habits. You know, we'll look at a couple of passages later from John 18 and Matthew 26, which kind of give us some details as far as what he had to do to fulfill his end of the bargain, and that really was not all that much. So that may be something that he thought it was not going to take that long. Maybe he thought it was not going to be that dangerous. From a biblical standpoint, the 30 pieces of silver were important. For what reason? Anybody remember what the prophet Zechariah had said back there in Zechariah chapter 11, verse 12? Had some information that related to Jesus. Talking about money, which happened to be how much? 30 pieces of silver. This is by no means the only passage which is prophetic about the Lord, but it certainly is one. And several points are made there that we could relate to Christ. It's also, I think, kind of interesting that Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18, says, we're not redeemed. Anybody remember the rest of that verse? We're not redeemed by gold or silver. Same word that's used here in Matthew 26, describing what was used to pay for Jesus' betrayal. Peter says we're not redeemed by that, but it was enough to pay, or at least that substance was sufficient to cause Judas to deliver up the Lord. Okay, let's pick up, as I said, these other two references that kind of give us some insight about Judas and what he felt like he had to do. John 18 is the first one, John 18 verses 2 through 4. The second one is going to come from Matthew 26, verse 48. John 18, 2 to 4. Who wants to take care of that one? You have a minute to get there if you're not there yet. Brian, John 18, verses 2, 3, and 4. And then from Matthew chapter 26, verse 48. Same chapter we're in, but a little later in the text. 26, 48. All right, Tina. Brian, if you're ready, let's look at John 18, verses 2 through 4.
And Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place, for Jesus oftentimes resorted there with the disciples. Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, cometh thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said unto them, Whom seek ye?
Okay. So rather than try to get Jesus to a certain place, as you look at this passage, and as I said, there's one more component, Matthew 26:48. Here it just seems to be an emphasis on knowing where Jesus was going to be, his locations, his whereabouts. People today will pay for that same kind of information, won't they? One of the big things right now, and if you use Facebook and some other things, let's just start with a question. Anybody used Facebook and, you know, maybe the day or two prior to the time you logged on to Facebook, you had checked, I'm going to say, you know, let's just say lipstick, your lady, and you had checked out some lipstick. And here you are, you're going through your Facebook post, and all of a sudden, there's some lipstick over there on the side of the page. Anybody ever had that experience? You've never seen those ads? Well, is Google just so smart, it just knows what's in your mind? How does it know? You're being tracked. People pay for information. Well, that's not new. So it seems in this particular case, the officials, if you can help us understand where he is, this was part of it, John chapter 18. The other major component of it appears to be found in Matthew 26, verse 48. And let's look at that.
Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, Whomever I kiss, he is the one, seize him.
Okay. This was about all that the officials needed, wasn't it? I'll bring you to the place where he is. I'll identify him with a kiss. I've done my job. I've done that small thing that I was thinking about. And now, whose responsibility is it from here? It's on you. So when you look at what Judas did, it may have seemed like the 30 pieces of silver were a pretty good deal because of the work involved. It really, to make good on the delivery promise, Matthew 26, verse 15, it really did not involve that much. All right, let's go back to our Luke reader. That's you, Steve. And look at Luke 22, verse 6. There's a detail here that is not in the other accounts, and it's a very, very interesting detail.
So he promised and sought opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude.
Okay, that word that's translated promised in the American Standard Translation, it's translated consent. This word is a very strong word. It's translated in different ways. John the Baptist, as he was baptizing people and they were confessing their sins back in Matthew chapter 3, verse 6, there it is translated confess. Now think about that. Confess. And then you have it used in Romans 14, verse 11, confessing God. And then Jesus is described as confessing, same word, confessing people before the Father in Revelation chapter 3, verse 5. Now when you think about Judas and you consider this word, what does it tell you about his commitment to betray Christ? I want my money. Don't just promise it to me. You weigh it out. And then from Judas's perspective, once he's gotten the money, is he an honest man when it comes to following through in this wicked deal? He is. You can depend on me. I'm going to follow through. And today there are people who are of that same mindset. When it comes to living in an honest and upright way, no interest whatsoever. But when it comes to having a pact, when it comes to having an agreement with a fellow thief or with a fellow person in evil, there are some folks who are just like Judas, and they will follow through on their word regardless of the cost. Anything you want to add or ask based on what we said thus far? Okay, let's look at some other things. One of the items that you may not have thought about, and it's maybe not brought up too often, but as you look at this apostle, that's Judas, you never find a single time in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John when he refers to Jesus as Lord. Now, that's a little unusual. There's a lot of information about some of the apostles that we do not have, but every single time this fellow is mentioned, we never find him addressing Jesus as Lord. The other apostles do. You see it in various places, but no example of Judas ever doing this. We also have, and this is probably understandable because of what he did, when you look at this fellow, he's always listed last in the places where the apostles are listed. And then you have some other things too. You recall from John chapter 4, or John chapter 12, verses 4 and 6, that Judas is described as a thief. Now we know he was one of the apostles. In Acts chapter 1, verse 17, the Bible tells us that he was numbered with the apostles. Sometimes folks have come along and said, well, you know, Judas really wasn't an apostle. He hung around with them and he did some things with them, and you know, he might be called an apostle, but he really was not an apostle. Well, that's not true. He was an apostle. But it seems that as you look at his spiritual heart, He was more interested in what than what?
Spiritual.
All right. More interested in the secular stuff than the spiritual stuff. And there's not a passage which specifically comes out and makes that point, but you do have that kind of thing. And eventually, we're getting to that point now. What's the devil come along and do? It's found in John 13, 21 and 27, but I think we remember. Satan comes along and the Bible says he entered him. Now, that's a scary thought. That's a frightening thought. But it seems that Judas had become so secular, so unrighteous, if you will, and that doesn't mean that he was out there drinking and carrying on in that kind of way, but so unspiritual that he allowed the devil to enter into him. He gave him that room, as we've talked about in the book of Revelation. He decided that he wasn't going to stay behind the wall, and the devil was there that was ready to pounce. As the Bible describes Satan entering Judas, would you say that Judas was demon-possessed? We do read about demon possession in the New Testament. You think that's what is being described?
I think he'd just gone off away from Christ's teaching to the point that it's like if we leave Christ's teaching,
yeah,
you know, Satan enters our heart.
Yeah. You leave the fold, you make yourself available, you expose yourself to Satan. So there have been some folks that have thought that Judas was demon-possessed, but I find no hint of that, and just find that view to be very, very difficult. You do find that, and it just seems like he was with them, but slip, 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 and finally he finds himself so low that he's willing to betray the Lord, and not really for that much money. Now, a lot of money wouldn't have changed anything, but still, you do find that steady departure from Christ, and it's kind of like today. People can grow closer and closer or further and further apart from him. Did you have another? Okay. Anybody else? Quiet group tonight. Okay, let's make a couple of other quick points. Judas's betrayal was bad, clearly very bad because of all the things that he'd witnessed with Jesus. But what about with the religious leaders? What would you say about them? Were they any different than Judas?
No. They've been trying all along to kill Christ because they were afraid that he would become king and be thrown down.
Yeah. You do have Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 8 that says the leaders didn't know, but they had that guilt as far as they were there, yeah, plotting with him. But they, as far as their understanding of Jesus, seemed to be a little less as far as their comprehension. But it's different guilt, if you will, in some ways, but both really could be faulted. With that point, I want to make this additional observation as well. In our time, if a person professes to be a spiritual leader, either by the title, by their clothing, a lot of folks will look at them and think, well, hey, you've got to have the truth, right? I mean, if you're a religious person, your way has to be right. When we look at what these guys did, though, they were wrong. And there should be a good, long, and lasting lesson there. Just because a person is religious, just because an individual claims to be a spiritual leader, that does not necessarily mean that he, and then when you get into the she, that's really a different category, is going to be someone who is heading people in the right direction. So the Bible tells us to study, to check things out, to make sure that we really are on the right path. I want to go in a slightly different direction for a minute, something, again, that we may not think about, but it is worth consideration. But before I do that, anything, once again, that you want to add or ask? One and two.
Do you think that the spiritual, the Jewish leaders and Judas knew the law and prophets enough, well enough, that when they agreed to 30 pieces of silver, that it didn't go ding, 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 ding? That sounds familiar.
Well, the priest should have known that. That actually is a good question that's going to relate to the next thing that I want to talk about. So let me do that. Then you might want to come back and make another comment on that. Don, you had a thought as well?
Could Jesus have been betrayed in any other way?
By Judas? You mean, could there have been another apostle that betrayed him?
Or other circumstances that he betrayed other than in the garden?
When you look at God, he had a plan to save man. And that plan was going to be fulfilled. Judas had free will. There, again, you kind of get back into the idea with God's knowledge, how all of that is going to unfold. But if we believe that God is an all-powerful God, and his plan, that's point number one. He's all-powerful. Point number two is the fact that his will says Jesus has to die for sin. Somehow, point number two is going to be accomplished. So if there were some scenario in which Judas did not work out, his plans were canceled before they were fulfilled, whatever it was, then based on who God is, I would contend that that plan would have still been fulfilled somehow.
But Jesus knew. Judas was going to be the one betrayed him.
Yeah, isn't it?
Judas even displayed any kind of indication of betrayal.
No. Is it? Let's go back to John 6 for just a second. I believe we have in John 6 a passage which says Jesus knew, maybe it's 6:64. Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not and who it was that should betray him. Yeah, there it is. Middle of the verse. First part of 64 says, but there are some of you that believe not. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not and who it was that should betray him. So there is the foreknowledge, but Judas is still the one who is exercising his free will throughout this entire process. But had there been, as I say, John 6:64 is difficult for me based on what it says to believe that there would have been a hiccup, because that would have said that Jesus was wrong. I mean, but somehow had there been a hiccup, God having that plan that Jesus was going to die for sin, he was going to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Abraham, did some things too that would seem to have headed God off in a different direction, but God always gets the job done. He never fails. And in this case, the Lord was going to be crucified. You had an additional thought there, maybe?
No, I don't think I'm moving forward.
Okay. All right, then let's pick up kind of with what Marcia was talking about and turn our attention to Satan for just a little bit. One of the things that strikes me as very, very odd is that the devil has some knowledge of Scripture, doesn't he? We saw that from the temptation of Jesus back in Matthew chapter 4. I mean, the devil's able to quote the Bible. All right, if the devil has some knowledge of the Bible, wouldn't you think that he would have been familiar with some of the passages in the Old Testament that talk? I mean, he's aware of the problem of sin, obviously. I mean, he's gotten Adam and Eve and everybody else involved with sin. And now you have passages like Isaiah 53 that we hear read quite often. Zechariah chapter 13, verse 1, God said there's going to be a fountain open for sin, for uncleanness. People are going to be forgiven of their sins. Well, that couldn't have been good news for the devil. Psalm 41, verse 9, with John 13, verse 18 and so forth. The whole book is about God's plan for redemption. The 30 pieces of silver. So as this stuff is beginning to unfold, the question that comes to my mind is, why on earth would the devil do things that seem to actually fulfill those parts of the Old Testament? Now, one might argue, well, the devil had some knowledge, but his knowledge wasn't sufficient. Well, that could be true. Or another possibility could be the idea that maybe, and this is almost unfathomable to me, but maybe the devil had the idea that he could overthrow God's plan. We can let these things work out. Well, if that didn't work out in heaven, whatever all that involved, way back when, if you go up against God the second time, you're probably not going to have a better outcome. And yet, Satan was willing to do this. He enters into Judas, and Judas comes against the Lord to betray him. And, you're delivering up the Son of God for the sacrifice of the world's sins, which is the last thing that you want to do. So it's very, very puzzling to me in some respects why Satan would have done what he did. And, specifically described as entering into Judas, it just seems puzzling. Then, Marcia, the point that you made, and that would be, you think about the priests, the scribes, and so forth. These fellas, Acts 8, the Ethiopian eunuch was familiar with Isaiah 53. He was thinking about it. It sounded good to him. And these guys, they've seen Jesus' teachings, his miracles. They've heard the reports of him for about 3.5 years. And it would be, this is the last guy that we want to mess with. Why on earth they did that? But sometimes people can become so upset. And maybe that was true of Satan as well, but sometimes people are just blinded to what would be a logical course of action, and maybe that's what happened here. But it is very, very puzzling that these fellas would have not And maybe some had some ideas, and they were shut down, or maybe they were just afraid to voice their opinions because the majority ruled. But it is strange.
Well, during the plagues in Egypt, God hardened Pharaoh's heart so that these things could all happen and so on. And it doesn't say anywhere that I don't get heard, but it says anywhere that God hardened the hearts of the
religious leaders.
No,
that Christ's actions did. They either brought people to him, they softened the hearts, or his actions repelled people.
I was just wondering, so that, you know, God blinded them, so they couldn't not do it. Nothing occurred to them this is all predicted.
Going back to the statement towards the end of 1 Corinthians 1, verse 28. It's at the end of the verse. He says, "And the base things of the world, and the things that are despised, did God choose. Yea, and the things that are not. And he might bring to naught the things that are." Let's see. That wasn't. What was that? That was 1 Corinthians 1:28. Talked about the rulers of the world. They would not have. Oh, it's 1 Corinthians 2:8. I'm sorry. "Which none of the rulers of this world hath known." He's talking about, verse 7, God's word and a mystery, that is the gospel, "which none of the rulers of this world had known. For had they known it, if they'd understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory."
So they had to crucify the Lord of glory, so they couldn't know.
Yeah. They just, well, even Jesus there on the cross, what did he say? "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." But part of that could have been jealousy. You know, the Bible does talk about Jesus being looked at in that way by officials. Anger, hate, you're upsetting the apple cart. I mean, overturning the temple at the beginning and the end of his ministry. And it probably, for some of them, it was just too much to handle. It was overload. And the only thing that we knew to do is get rid of you. And that's what we see here. Betty?
Well,